Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
I think he was absolutely the right man for the time. The public wanted heroes. They wanted these aces. They needed them. And I think he was absolutely the right man for the time. It was interesting learning more about him. There were times I thought, oh, I'm not sure about you. Then another time I'd look at something else and think, for heavens, how admirable.
Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Legendary Battle of Britain fighter ace Stamford Tuck is the subject of a new book by Helen Doe, Stamford Tuck, Hero of the Battle of Britain, The Life of the Great Fighter Ace, and it's published by Grub Street, and it's available now. Helen's a historian, author, and speaker, heavily published for maritime history. Helen wrote the biography of her father, Bob Doe, called Fighter Pilot, and has appeared across international media. She's a fellow of the University of Exeter, a fellow of the Royal Historical Society, and a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts. She's also squeezing in vice chair of the British Commission for Maritime History. So with all of that, Helen, welcome to Extended.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Peter.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Really enjoyed the book. It was quite a refreshing read. But let's kick off. Tuck's a bit of a legendary hero in particularly in the aviation world, and he's been the subject of a lot of books, a lot of content. We've also seen lots and lots of work for pilots like Bader and people like that. Why has it taken so long for something as substantial as this to come out about Stamford Tuck?
I'll be quite honest, I really don't know. He should have had probably as many books as Bader did or some of the others like Sailor Milan. But somehow, I don't think he got forgotten, but possibly that everybody thought Fly for Your Life was the book and that was it. I don't know.
Yeah. And Fly for Your Life, written by Larry Forrester, of course, was, what's that, 50s, 60s, I think, from memory.
1956, yeah.
1956. It was quite an embellishment of Tuck's life. Do you think that was really what Tuck was about, or do you think there was a bit of extra sell to get the book numbers up in that?
Well, yes, there was embellishment, and frankly, that was also what they did at the time. In the 50s, Guy Walters has written a really good book about the Great Escape and just shown how much that was embellished because it was written by a journalist who wanted to write an exciting story. And that's what people wanted in the 50s. It was quite a grey world post-war.
Yeah.
People wanted their heroes larger than life. And then you've also got Bader's first biography, which has Reach for the Sky. And we know that's not a true depiction of Bader. It was a very sanitized view of him. But all of those books are what people wanted. Now, Forrester's book, I think, was very good. I mean, he could write very exciting way, which is no wonder he went on to be such a film screenwriter. I wish I could write that way. But he wasn't writing the kind of history I write.
Yeah.
And also there's more information now, much more information about these men because the files are more available.
Yeah, Yeah. And so why did you feel the need to pick this topic up and go into such detail? Because the book's an interesting blend, actually. There's an interesting blend of a bit more substance around Tuck, but also the context. You do a great job of bringing the context of some of those pieces about him into play.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, I came across him when I wrote, you mentioned my book about my father, and that was my first foray into the RAF in the Second World War. And I learnt so much there, but I came across Tuck when I was doing that one. And I came across him a couple of times, just purely, you know, by coincidence. And at one stage, I thought, well, I've got to look up this man's biography. Found there was just the one. And as I was reading it, I thought, nice book, but is that really what happened? Because yeah. The way it was written, it was written almost as a screenplay. You could see the film, you know, the sort of images coming before your eyes, the way he wrote it.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, there's got to be more.
And is that the academic in you, if you don't mind me asking, coming out and analysing that sort of thing? Because to be fair, until I really thought about that, I'd just been absorbed by all of those wonderful stories, books, anecdotes and legends, and it becomes part of your belief system. I just wonder if, we're getting to the place now where, people like yourselves are saying, well, hang on a sec, you know, maybe it's not like that. Let's do that detail. Is that the academic in you that's doing that, or is that a trend?
My academic training clearly is, it comes into this, and that's what makes you kind of dig round and try to be balanced. You know, we do try really hard to be balanced and not to be biased in what we're looking at, and try to be open-minded and look at all the evidence. So it has to be very evidence-based, which is why there are endnotes in there. So people can say, well, how did she find that out? And then they can judge whether they feel that's a reliable source. You know, they make that judgment, not me. They can decide whether I've used a reliable source or not. But also, I think today's audience, I mean, this book, Fly For Your Life, so many men especially have said, that was given to me when I was a young boy by, you know, relative, my parents or whatever, and I loved it. And it was just, you know, this was this great hero, this wonderful story. It's a kind of boy's own story.
Yeah.
But today I think we look a little bit harder at people. We want to understand a little more. We know that they have their weaknesses as well as their strengths. We want to know they're human beings. And I think that's really what I was looking at. The man as a human being, he wasn't perfect. When I wrote my father's biography, he wasn't perfect. One of the things that helped with my father's biography, my problem there was every time I spoke to somebody, knowing that I was his daughter, they would only tell me nice things.
Yeah.
I thought, come on, nobody goes through a war without upsetting someone. And then to my delight with my father's biography, I found someone who served with him in India and couldn't abide his commanding officer.
Yeah.
That was perfect. That gave me that other picture. And the same thing with this one. I didn't find somebody who necessarily couldn't abide him, but I found another contemporary witness who brought another dimension.
Right.
And that helps. You know, we see these people in the round.
No, really interesting that. So let's talk a little bit about him and a bit about some of the things you unearthed in the book. I was intrigued by the focus on his early life. Why did you spend so much time explaining his background? Was it to demystify some of the legend that was there, or was it to lay the groundwork for, as you say, him being more human?
That's right. It really, sort of, that just that one chapter takes it up to the point where he joins the RAF. But I do think that's important, because that really tells you about his background. This is meeting at Baker Street with his other fellow recruits.
Yeah.
And some of them come from very, very distinguished backgrounds themselves, quite rich. And here he is, not quite got the background that it was suggested in Fly For Your Life. I also think that he's, as a younger son, he was failing at various jobs. And I think his father got very frustrated that he didn't seem to settle. So I think he was trying to prove himself. So that's why I look at the background, because those early days have a very strong influence on people in later life. Hmm. So both his family background and his own kind of career, his school career and his job career before he joined the RAF, has an impact. And I think we can see that going forward.
Yeah, and he later on, when he was in captivity, he actually came across a chap from his school and was used to test his knowledge. But we'll come to that in a little bit. Let's talk about how he moved into flying then and his flying training. Can you take us a bit through some of the story of that? Because I think there's also a belief that, you know, Battle Britain pilots in World War II sort of appeared in 1939 as aces and just got jumped in a plane and flew off. But he started much earlier, didn't he? And I thought that was really interesting.
He started in the mid 1930s, and that I found, because one of the joyful things about research is you learn so much yourself, and I learned a lot about the early days of the RAF. And one of the things that struck me particularly is the high death rate. By the time they've got to war, these young men have seen death up close. Yeah. Because there's been so many accidents. The accident rate was horrendous. And through that chapter, I show that the various fatalities that Tuck is involved in.
Yeah.
You know, so accidents in the air, or just a fellow pilot who flew off and didn't come back. So they've already experienced that.
Hmm.
And also he's learning on all sorts of aircraft, you know, that help him in his preparation for when he's flying later on.
Yeah, I was intrigued by the number of different aircraft types. And also during the book, he jumps into various aircraft almost as a natural one and flashes off. And I'm sure it wasn't quite like that. But as you say, the multiple aircraft types was quite interesting. He was also embroiled in a few accidents as well. And at first it felt like he was a good pilot for sure. And that certainly comes out later, but he wasn't a natural pilot at first. He had to work quite hard, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And that's something that you see in his logbook, in that he's not, he doesn't do it quickly, and he doesn't get high praise for his flying until a bit later.
Hmm.
So he's not a natural. And whether that was down to confidence, or whether that was down to the way he was taught, or the type of aircraft he was flying, very difficult to tell.
But certainly
it wasn't the kind of instant brilliance that you might want to see.
Yeah. And again, I suppose that's my little boy's mind playing on, as we said, you know, those books that I'd been brought up with, where those legends just seem to naturally take to the air and become acclaimed pilots. And it really explains that journey that he went on. As you say, he saw his friends and his colleagues in incidents and accidents, a few of which he got a bit caught up in as well. And it weaves a really interesting tapestry that lays that sort of foundation. And I was almost into the Battle of Britain before I realized I was there, because the story runs at such a pace at that point. There's so much going on for him. But talk us through how, you know, those very early war years, because again, they didn't quite pan out for him the way I'm sure he would have liked them to have been.
Well, from 1939 onwards. The thing is, you've got this phony war going on. The other thing I found very interesting, the Battle of Barking Creek.
Yeah.
Now, people know about the Battle of Barking Creek, where, you know, this is the first friendly fire incident. But I wasn't aware until I looked at it that Tuck's squadron was involved.
Yeah.
Now, this isn't mentioned in his first biography at all. That might be because I think there'd been a really heavy clampdown on discussion of it.
Yeah.
You know, it was had to be kept totally secret. They couldn't allow that information out. And so perhaps in the 50s, he still felt that wasn't something to talk about. But I found it very interesting. There's been some very good recent research that's looked at it more closely. So that I found odd that wasn't in his book, but I was pleased I was able to put it in.
Yeah. And again, that was an example, I think, of those contexts, you know, the points about bringing a context around his life, because obviously as an individual, it's hard to delve into what he was thinking and how he was responding emotionally to some of these things. But I think it was quite clear that some of those events had a very big effect on him and affected the way he was.
And of course, then, you know, when we have the battle for France, you know, there's no rushing into, because we get the phony war. There's nothing much happening because Dowding's keeping Spitfire squadrons back. And the first sort of thing that he does, he's escorting Winston Churchill across the channel. Winston Churchill's doing shuttle, what we now call shuttle diplomacy. And then when his first serious combat is over Dunkirk.
Yeah, that's right. And
on the very first day, they lose so many of their squadron.
Yeah, it's so hard and painful to read. And I felt quite emotive about some of those things. And I wonder about the impact on those young men going into battle. And it does come across a little bit, but what also comes across in the book is, I was going to use the word how desperate, but how keen he was to simply always be up in the air, always be up at every opportunity. And as he progressed and became more successful as a fighter pilot, shooting down and claiming confirmed and unconfirmed kills, it's almost like it became a bit of an addiction for him to be up a lot.
It's quite interesting. There's one thing I quote from Gordon Olive, who's a fellow pilot. And Gordon Olive says that whereas everybody else was exhausted, Tuck still seemed to be buzzing.
Yeah.
He called it a peculiar vitality, I think are his words. Tuck was a restless creature. I think that's what happened in his before he joined the RAF. He was a restless young man. And he just couldn't abide sitting around and not doing anything. And he had to get out there and up and at them. Whereas other pilots would go, well, okay, well, we've got a few days off, let's go and have a rest. He'd go and find an aeroplane and get out there. That was him.
Yeah, I want to come back to that point. But one of the things you mentioned there, having a rest, they were sent to Wales. His squadron was sent to Wales, which was for him quite troubling because he felt that he was away from the action. And I think the local population as well weren't particularly receptive until, of course, they got those handful of confirmed kills. And then his reputation started to build from that, didn't it?
It's interesting to think that if they hadn't sent the squadron, 92 squadron, over to Wales, you know, what would his score have been like?
Yeah.
But yes, the squadron was furious at being banished as far as they were concerned, because as far as they were aware, nothing was happening in Wales. That they turned out to be wrong on that.
Yeah.
And I always remember reading the fact that they flew across, I think it was Tony Bartley saying, they flew across southern England, and when they got to Pembury, they buzzed every single building field they could find, the whole squadron did, and just sort of said, you know, announce we're here, which didn't really endear them to everybody locally.
Yeah, that's right.
It wasn't until, as you say, they started shooting down some of the bombers that were coming across that they were better received locally.
Yeah.
Yes, they did feel they'd been banished. Yeah. And it was an interesting thing to do, to send them over there for a while. But perhaps they felt they'd been so devastated over Dunkirk. And it's all about resting your squadrons and your really good pilots. It's like any kind of big team, isn't it? You know, what stage in the game do you bring them on?
Yeah. Yeah, and I thought it was quite interesting because he's starting to become more well known, of course, for his credits. He's starting to progress and be awarded more accolades. Mm-hmm. And they move back over to the east of the country, and it's just like set him free. You know, he just goes bananas. But I want to come back to that point about flying on his own. And he was, without a shadow of a doubt, a fabulous, by this time, particularly skilled, and was very, very capable. But as his numbers increased and the claims increased, was he lucky? Was he in the right place at the right time? Or was this desire for him to often go up on his own a driver for him to just keep adding to the number tally?
I think there's probably a mixture of all of those. It's very hard to tell without asking the man himself.
Yeah.
That's one of the challenges we have. Yes, I think there was an element of luck. I mean, certainly Blanchard, who was his kind of number two in 257 Squadron,
yep,
said, you know, that he'd flown in the same area and hadn't seen this aircraft, which Tuck shot down and was confirmed.
Confirmed, yeah.
There were others where perhaps people thought, did that happen really? Because they weren't necessarily confirmed. Mm. But he did seem to have luck, but he also was very determined. Perhaps he just knew where to look. But also the fact that he just went up time and time again. You see it frequently when he's leading 257. He just heads off on his own. And you know, that's what ultimately loses and is shot down because he just decided he's feeling restless, got to do something, gets out in an aircraft and goes.
And in your research, Helen, was that something common for other pilots?
I haven't studied other pilots in the same way I've studied Tuck, apart from my father. And I think that was the Polish. The Czech, Franicek. Franicek was, I think, and I'm not an expert on him at all. Hmm. I think the Czechs and the Poles are very good at just positioning themselves. Franicek, I think, often used to position himself as the Luftwaffe were coming heading home, and he wouldn't fly with the rest of the squadron. He'd go and do his own thing, and they were very successful in that way. They just positioned themselves where they knew they'd come through and just picked them off that way.
Did you know that the RP-3 rocket projectile, used to great effect by Hawker Typhoons in the tank-busting ground attack role, was originally conceived as an air-to-air weapon to attack Luftwaffe bomber streams? Did you also know that in the 1950s, an indigenous light aircraft built in the Philippines was skinned with woven bamboo matting? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
He was picking up accolades all the time, and eventually this came out in the press, he became... I don't know, a media star, but it became well known that he was.
I would say
something.
A media star at his age, yes.
Yeah, okay, thank you. And, you know, even the cover of the book, I think, you know, this sort of dashing young man, fighter pilot, it is amazing. You couldn't write it, you know, you couldn't draw a better picture to sum him up. You know, this dashing young man, he was a fighter pilot, you know, he shot down lots of aircraft. How was that received by colleagues? Was, you know, because he was great with his men, wasn't he? He was really good to his men. Was there, you know, how was that seen by some of the people in the RAF?
To begin with, the RAF did not want the press to have individual names of fighter aces at all, because they felt that'd be very divisive. But people wanted their heroes. They saw them fighting above their heads. They wanted to know who are these guys. And so eventually they had to sort of give way. And then the publicity machine of the RAF took over. And so Tuck was not the only one. I mean, there's Salem and Lahn and all the others are heavily reported in the press and do become this focus of media attention. And it was very heavy media attention because everyone was desperate to have their heroes and have good news stories.
Yeah.
And positive news stories. And, you know, these guys were so good looking for their time.
Yeah.
Dashing, and that helped enormously.
Yeah. Dashing guy. And there's some great photos as well. You know, it just fabulous. We'll try and put a few of those in with the episode when it goes out. But his luck did run out eventually. And he did get shot down and he did get captured, and you know, I'm not giving away the story here, I think most people will know. But there was a big risk with that. Now he was a well-known a media star of the day. He was well known for whatever reason. He had an iron cross as his lucky charm.
Not the best thing we found with.
No, exactly. But when he was shot down, it was quite intriguing how he was handled by the Germans, wasn't it?
Yes, because Adolf Galland heard that Tuck had been shot down, and of course either side kind of knew and respected the top aces on both sides. And Galland had already wined and dined Baader in the same way.
Yeah.
And so he did the same thing for Tuck and brought him to the mess, gave him cigarettes and a bottle of whiskey and you know, looked after him before he was then shunted off to prisoner war camp.
Yeah. And where things didn't stay on that standing, he became part of the POW system. But as in life, in active service, he was not a man to be put down, was he? He was particularly heavily involved in escape activities.
Yeah. And again, we've got to remember this restless character. He needed to be doing something. The thing that I really think is important to remember is he's gone from being headline news to being nothing. He can't go off and just get in an aircraft and fly when he feels restless. He's stuck in a camp with, you know, a lot of other men, and he doesn't know when he's going to get out.
Yeah.
This is tough for a restless spirit like him. People dealt with captivity in all sorts of different ways. He then ends up sharing a room with Roger Bushell. Now, that must have been an interesting meeting, because last time the two had seen each other was just before Dunkirk, when Roger Bushell was the squadron leader. And Tuck was a mere flight, just hadn't even got his promotion to like flight lieutenant. Well, since then, Tuck's become a wing commander, you know, with an impressive list of kills.
Yeah.
So he outranks his former boss. That's tricky.
Yeah, particularly in that time. But never to be put down, he got involved in multiple escape activities, didn't he?
Well, he was... I mean, Bushell, of course, is the great escaper, as that wonderful book by Simon Pearson is entitled. But he's involved in the Great Escape. He obviously, you know, you can't share a room in that way with someone like Bushell, and it would be very hard to keep him out of it. So Tuck gets involved in that. But after one tunnel is found, they decide they're going to sort of lay low for a while, but they still determined to carry on. And so Tuck makes two escape attempts with others, which are unsuccessful, but at least it keeps the guards aware that there's still a rebel in there.
Yeah. Yeah. And, given his status and given that the Germans understood his status, they didn't appear to give him particular attention, did they? Because, I mean, an escape by Tuck would have been massive publicity, you know, but they didn't seem to. They, you know, the camp commanders that he's had were quite reasonable with him, treated them all quite well and with respect until they tried to break out, in which case, obviously, you know, lockdown ensued. but I was genuinely surprised to see that they didn't keep a special eye on Tuck and some of the others.
No, they seem to treat them much the same. I think they kept a close eye on Bushell because his record was known in terms of successful escapes. And I think Tuck was also a great charmer. So he was very good at charming people.
Yeah.
And, of course, they wanted to keep quiet about what they were doing. They didn't want to – but what's interesting, it's just before the Great Escape, Tuck and several others are picked out and removed to another camp.
Yeah.
Because it's thought they are some of the ringleaders of the Great Escape. Bushell at the time had got himself, apparently, to the Germans' viewpoint, very involved. He wasn't involved in escaping. He was involved in amateur dramatics.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a cover. But for some reason, they decided to leave Bushell there. They must have suspected. But they moved Tuck and several others, including several who had no involvement in the Great Escape at all, and just purged them out to another camp. That, again, I think, is worth remembering, that they're moved. A short time later, the Great Escape happens. Tuck was supposed to be partnering, because they were all going out in pairs. Tuck was supposed to be partnering with Roger Bushell. What those men must have gone through hearing, because there's also Wally Floody, who's one of the great mining experts, who's been really crucial to the whole Great Escape story. He's been purged as well to Bellario with Tuck.
G'day, I'm Steve Fisher,
and I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
Years, and who are now being murdered. It's hard to think about that.
Yeah, and I think you do a really great job at explaining that mental pressure that they were on, and how that could impact them. Because, again, you know, those historical films, books don't really do that. It's a jolly good show stuff, and, you know, there's all that bonhomie. But the reality was that they had these challenges we now talk about so openly in life, of well-being and mental health challenges and so forth. And there were some who just didn't make it. That I thought that was really interesting to try and understand that.
I was helped a lot by, you know, Guy Walter's book, his reanalysis of the Great Escape. But also there's Dr. Kristen Alexander, who's an Australian.
Yeah.
She's just brought out her book, Kriegis. And I strongly recommend it. Anybody wants to read about the impact of being a POW. Because she looks specifically at the Australians in Stalag Luft 3. And got access to their medical records post-war.
Okay.
So she was really able to understand the impact that captivity had on them. So I was very fortunate. She was really kind and let me use some of her research.
Yeah.
That and other material helps to provide that depth.
Yeah, and that's right. It did feel very deep. And again, it was an aspect of these individuals' lives that we wouldn't normally have thought about in the past, but really brings it to life. And I suppose for me, I just felt even more endeared to the strength of character that some of these people like Tuck had.
Oh, they were amazing. I mean, I've researched and written, you know, with these two books of mine, I've just come away so admiring of that whole generation, men and women.
Yeah,
they were quite amazing.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. You know, a little anecdote from my life. My grandfather was in the Merchant Navy in the First World War. He escaped, not quite sure how, but from Africa, went to Ruleben, and had a terrible time there. And again, putting it into context, we only know the physical injuries that he suffered. But that mental, the mental challenges, reading this sort of thing brings it into context to make it much more whole experience, to understand how challenging they were. But let's get back to Tuck. How did he eventually get back to England then?
Well, he finally escaped. I think he was just determined to escape. And I think the fact that missed out on the Great Escape kind of was perhaps bugging him. But also, say this restlessness shows it again, because of course the Russians are advancing, and the Germans start to empty the prisoner of war camps, and this is what becomes known as the Long March, where these POWs are sent in horrendous conditions and marched for days and days. And he's teamed up already previously with this Polish pilot, Kostrzenski. And the two of them had come up with a plan. They clearly thought it through beforehand. And they perhaps, and I think they must have collected some money and some of the sorts of things that they needed for their escape. Anyways, they spent two nights on the Long March and then stayed behind when they were in a big barn. And when everybody was marched out, they were hidden. And they stayed behind. Now, they're a really interesting partnership, because Kostrzenski was born in Moscow. His father was a diplomat.
Yeah.
So from a good middle-class background. He speaks Russian fluently, as you would then in those days. So he is Tuck's ticket to freedom. But also Tuck is Kostrzenski's ticket to freedom, because Tuck, being so well known, is going to help Kostrzenski get out and keep him safe. So the two have this really important relationship. And what they do is essentially they just bunk down in this barn. There's a Russian family there who Kostrzenski speaks to, who've been sort of slave labor to the Germans, and they hide them and look after them for a few days until the Russians overtake. And then they become effectively prisoners of the Russians.
Yeah. And when he comes back to England and to the UK, the spotlight continues, really, doesn't it? Never really stops for him.
No, he's... I think because of his tremendous war record, you know, he's been out of the spotlight for a few years because he's a prisoner of war, but he comes back and, you know, his great friends with Baader. And so Baader ensures that he's involved in various things. Salem Alarms by then going back to South Africa. And yes, I mean, he goes across to the US with Baader. They're going to so many things. He also develops this wonderful friendship with Adolf Galland, because Galland is captured by the British, and Tuck meets him whilst he's at prisoner of war. So the table totally turned.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Which is quite interesting. Galland goes off to Argentina for a while and then comes back, and then meets up with Tuck. And they become very good friends. Tuck actually becomes godfather to Galland's son.
Yeah. And what did Tuck end up doing later in his life? Obviously no longer around.
Well, he stays in the RAF for a while. But like a lot of these people, post-war RAF wasn't for him. It's such a totally different world. And so he leaves, and he works for General Electric for a while, where they're testing Canberras and things like that. Although he was not a test pilot, he was more involved in sort of the sales side.
Yeah.
But he does makes that sense. For a few years, and then he becomes a mushroom farmer. He becomes a mushroom farmer in Kent and does that.
You just can't write it, really, can you?
Totally
you can't write it. You can't write it. And, of course, he was involved in the Battle of Britain film as well.
That's right. And he wasn't just, we see photographs of Battle of Britain pilots on the film set, but they were mostly visiting. Tuck had a particular role there. He was there as the main advisor to the script and to the action scenes for all of the RAF shots. And Galland was doing the same for the Luftwaffe shots.
Yeah.
So when there was a lot of filming went on in Spain, the two of them were down there. And one of the photographs in the book shows them checking the script. So they were very involved in that, whereas Baader, Townsend and others and Ginger Lacey were really sort of visiting for publicity shots.
So Helen, I suppose in the round, putting you on the spot a little bit, how do you emotionally connect with Tuck? How do you feel that legacy, that legend came about and is and was, and the impact that he had on the RAF and his legacy to flying?
I think he was absolutely the right man for the time. The public wanted heroes. They wanted these aces. They needed them. And I think he was absolutely the right man for the time. It was interesting learning more about him. There were times when I thought, I'm not sure about you. Then another time I'd look at something else and think, for heavens, how admirable.
Yeah.
And I tried to look at him through other people's eyes, which is why I was so lucky to get some of these contemporary views of him. And he was, I think you said already, he was much admired, and quite rightly. So I really summarized the fact that he was highly skilled, very brave, and weren't we lucky to have men like him?
Yeah, very much so. I couldn't have summed that up better. I was conflicted a little bit reading his journey by some of those challenges. You know, was how much was he driven by ego, but then it was balanced off by how good he was with his teams and with his men and how supportive he was. And then it was, well, is he off going and claiming kills? And then we'd look at another part of his story. So I sort of had that conflict all the way through, but I couldn't have summed it up really any better, Helen. So let's leave the discussion about Tuck there. It's a fabulous book. It's published by Grub Street. I know you've got lots of books, but this struck me, this book. It's a nice, solid, physical piece of work. But as I said, that picture says it all. And it stands out really well. Are you really pleased with that?
I'm thrilled with that. When I was asked by Grub Street, did I have any ideas for the cover? I said, there's only one, because Cuthbert Ord was the artist, and he did a lot of pencil drawings that we know well from the Battle of Britain. But he only did, I think, three or so, I could be wrong, three or so paintings. And it just so happened he did this one of Tuck.
Yeah.
And it was so stunning. But also the guy who designed the cover did a brilliant job in using that.
Yeah.
So I'm thrilled with it. I think it's a really super cover. I think Grub Street did a great job there.
They did. They really did a good job. It looked good on anyone's bookshelf. And of course, they can't see this because they're listening, but I love the little small version on the spine of the book. So you actually can see it in your bookshelf. It's just a little touch.
They're getting the spine right so it stands out. I thought that was good too.
Yeah, so highly recommended. Before I let you go, though, Helen, I just do want to find out a little bit more about your father, Bob Doe, and the book Fighter Pilot. Sorry, can you tell us a little bit about that so I can get a bit of a flavour for your father's?
My background as a historian, I've largely done kind of maritime type books. My father died in 2010. Now, he didn't talk much about his RAF career when I was growing up. He was still in the RAF when I was growing up. But he didn't talk very much about his wartime career. I don't think many of them did.
No.
But when he brought out his memoirs in the 90s. But memoirs tend to be, and he was the kind of man who was very good at telling nice stories. So memoirs tend to be a bit one-sided. They don't give you the total picture. And he was also well known for being particularly modest about things. So I felt after he died, someone needed to look at his career. And so I took that task on. It was a steep learning curve. I learned a heck of a lot. And learned so much about this person. I had to put him being my father to one side.
Was that difficult? I mean, I know when I've talked about my father, I just get too connected. I'm too emotional. How were you able to do that? I find that very difficult.
I still get a bit emotional if I talk to him about him as my father. So what I did for the book and what I do when I give talks is I talk about Bob Doe.
Yeah.
Because Bob was a young man I never met. Because by the time I met him, he was that much older. He was a different person in a way to the young man who went through this incredible wartime experience. You know, he was only 20 in the Battle of Britain and only 24 when he took on building up this, establishing an Indian Air Force squadron and flying over Burma. That's hard to kind of think about, isn't it? Those ages.
It is. I mean, my father was 18, and now we know what post-traumatic stress disorder is. Mm. We've recognised that, obviously, he had that. So there are things that he's seen, which we know only a tiny, tiny little bit about.
I had to put that to one side and know that I was looking at a young man and try and again, I think my history training helps, tries to be objective. Hmm. And so being a trained historian, I think, really helped in that way. And also looking at a range of primary and secondary sources to get that context. One of the things my father was always keen on was that those who didn't come back were remembered. And that was a kind of torch I carried.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to look at all the people he served with and get stories about them, particularly ones that might not have been very well known at all.
Yeah. So and also that part of the war in Burma wasn't really well covered. It's becoming
it's not at all well covered.
Notable now, but not so much.
And also I think the problem with, because it was Indian Air Force as well, that was almost forgotten, because British historians have tended to ignore the Indian Air Force, thinking it's totally Indian. And Indian historians ignore the fact that there were British, Australian, New Zealanders, Canadians in there. So it kind of gets lost, I think, between the two sets of history. So I found it also very difficult writing biography because I was trained to look at themes. And so with a biography, you've got to kind of know the beginning and the end, don't you, really? It helps to kind of do a chronological way of looking at things.
Yeah.
Because that is how a person develops. So I had to take a theme, and the theme I took was my father got his DSO for leadership. He had a DSO and two DFCs. So my theme through it was, how did this young man, who apparently left school at the age of 14 with no qualifications, son of a gardener, how did he become an officer in the RAF and achieve such heights? So what influenced him? Who influenced him? And I think you can be influenced by lack of leadership as well as positive leadership.
Absolutely.
So that's something as well I wanted to look at, and that's what took me through that book.
Right. It's definitely on my Christmas list, as we said, offline. I'm really looking forward now to reading that, because I've also got, for no particular reason, a fascination in the air war over Burma, probably because it's not been covered. So I'm really looking forward to reading that, Helen. And we'll put links to both the books in the show notes. But where can we find you online?
You can go to my website, which is helendoe.uk.
Okay.
Very straightforward. It's all there.
Excellent. I'll put that in the show notes as well. So that's it. We're really keen to hear your comments and feedback on Helen's book. So contact us on social media or by email. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Ellie, Gareth and Tim on the extended Twitter, Facebook, Threads and Instagram feeds. So that's it with the Rival of the Music. It's goodbye from Helen.
Goodbye. Thank you for having me on your show.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.